Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Indeed, we had to work to pay the cost. That is the great Dar Williams singing along with Pete Seeger on the Solartopia song. Here we are on the Green Power show, the Green Power and Wellness show. I'm Harvey Wasserman. We are joined today, and we're doing this on Skype for the first time, so we hope this is working well. We're doing this today to talk about Iran. The possibility of a horrendous, horrific, worthless, useless attack on the country of Iran and its 79 million people and its alliances with India, China, and Russia. We're joined by the great Stephen Kinzer, author, journalist, activist, a superb speaker at college commencement talks, and we're going to talk with him a bit about the role of spiritualism and inner strength in activism and reshaping the world. Stephen, are you with us?
I am indeed. It's great to be with you, Harvey.
Stephen, it's great to meet on the phone. I want to start right in. You have a long, illustrious career as a journalist, an author, and an activist, which is a great combination. We all love that combination. You've heard the Solartopia theme song, a Vision of a Green Powered Earth. But to get there, we are going to have to end war. And I think those of us in the United States here who have seen our country ruined by war, starting with Vietnam, although you could date it back to Korea, I suppose, but certainly the mid-60s, this country went straight downhill after the escalation of the war in Vietnam and really hasn't stopped sliding. And now we're looking at the possibility of an attack on Iran, allegedly, to prevent them from building nuclear weapons. And you are the expert, Stephen. You have numerous books out, and including at least one on Iran, which you can give us the title for, and your website just to start out. And then why don't you tell us what your thinking might be on the possibility of a war with Iran?
Well, first of all, just to answer the technical questions, it's true. I wrote a book about the episode that started our trouble with Iran, which was the overthrow of the democratic government there in 1953. That's called All the Shah's Men. In that book, I try to answer this question, why is it that we got off on such a bad track with Iran? For Americans, I think U.S.-Iran relations begin and end with the hostage crisis. We're still in that paradigm. We still haven't gotten out of that one.
As a college teacher, I always assume that my students don't know anything about what I'm talking about. So why don't you tell us real quickly about the 1979 Iran hostage crisis, 78-79, and what went on there?
This was a very searing moment for all Americans who were alive then. And, of course, the generation of people growing up then is the generation that's now running America and American foreign policy. So this episode is very much seared into their minds. A group of Iranian students stormed into the American embassy, violating international law, and seized the embassy and took a number of American hostages, held 59 of them for more than a year. And this created an intense passion in the United States. We were subjected to nightly reports that showed pictures of bearded students leading blindfolded Americans around, and they used this slogan they had painted on the wall, U.S. cannot do anything. This was very humiliating for Americans, and it led us to develop this idea that Iranians were completely savage. They were just nihilistic for no reason at all. They would carry out such a terrible act. So what I try to do is answer this question, was it really just nihilism, or was there something else behind it? Now we have had actually memoirs from some of those people who were in 1979 among the hostage takers, and they've written something very interesting, which is, we remembered what had happened in 1953. What happened then? There was a revolution in Iran sponsored by the United States. That revolution destroyed Iranian democracy. And the way it was organized was by CIA agents working in the basement of the American embassy. The Shah had been forced to flee, but these American CIA operatives organized a revolution in Iran, brought the Shah back, and that led to 25 years of dictatorship in Iran. So when these
Stephen, what was the motivation? Why did the CIA want to get rid of Mossadegh and put in the Shah? I mean, and carry that forward to today. What are our interests there that prompted us to do that?
Well, I think there are two reasons. One of which is still very much applicable today. The reasons that we wanted to overthrow Mossadegh had in part to do with the Cold War. But there was another very important reason, and I think it was the more important reason, and that is oil. Anytime a big power in the world shapes its policy toward the Middle East, oil is always going to be a big factor. It's naive to think otherwise. At that time, all Iranian oil was owned by one British company. And actually, Iranian oil is what allowed the British to live at the standard of living that they did all during the 1920s and 30s and 40s. Britain has no oil, has no colonies that have oil. So Iranian oil was fundamental to British prosperity, and it was Iranian oil that allowed the Royal Navy to project British power all over the world. So in the period after World War II, when Iran developed a democracy, that democracy decided it wanted to nationalize Iranian oil. This set the British into a panic, and with the Americans, they organized a coup against Mossadegh. So if you understand what a searing memory that is for Iranians, they didn't just lose one prime minister. It wasn't just Mossadegh. They lost their democracy, and they fell under dictatorship. So when the
and
Shah...
And it was our dictator, right? The Shah was basically our guy.
We put him in, and actually you could have argued that that operation was a great success for at least 25 years. You could say that we got rid of a guy we didn't like, Mossadegh, and we replaced him with a guy that would do everything we wanted. That was the Shah.
And we did that. Now, the Iran, of course, was not an isolated situation. We did the same thing in Indonesia with overthrowing Sukarno and putting in Suharto. We installed Marcos in the Philippines, Arbenz in Guatemala. All over the world we did this. And you've written a lot about this, right, Stephen?
The impulse to intervene in the affairs of other countries is something that is a theme running through American history all the way back to the 19th century. In the modern age, Iran is one country that has seen this repeatedly. When the students seized hostages in 1979, this is what they were thinking. Look at what happened in 1953. The Shah had been forced to flee, but CIA agents working in the American embassy organized a coup and brought him back. Now it's 1979. The Shah has fled again, the same Shah. So we feared that history would repeat itself. CIA agents working in the basement of the embassy would organize a coup and bring the Shah back. When you know that, you realize that it's understandable why, for Americans, the hostage crisis is the big episode in our history, but actually for Iranians, the biggest episode in the history of our relations was the overthrow of their democracy in 1953.
Right, which nobody in the United States ever talks about except journalists and authors like yourself. So it's from 1979, the Ayatollah took power. And I guess one of the last guys the United States wanted in there, Jimmy Carter, really got his undies in a bunch about the hostage crisis and turned it into a national test of will and cost him the election, gave us Ronald Reagan. There is, of course, as a footnote, and maybe you want to comment on it, a theory that the incoming Reagan team with William Casey and George H.W. Bush conspired to delay the release of the hostages until after the 1980 election so that Reagan could win. As a footnote, what do you think about that theory?
We've heard about that. There's some evidence for it. In any case, it's remarkable that it was actually inauguration day, the very day that Reagan took office, that the hostages were released. So that speaks for itself.
Right. Well, this is called the October Surprise. I actually did a lot of writing and organizing about it. I think it's highly possible that Reagan's team, election team, negotiated a backdoor, which is a treasonous event, to delay the release of the hostages. 2 weeks prior to the 1980 election, Jimmy Carter was ahead in the polls. But when it came clear that that the hostages weren't going to get out, he lost. It's his own making, but you know, the whole country paid, of course, for 8 years of Ronald Reagan and four more of George H.W. Bush. So that's part of the Iranian mystique, I suppose. But since then, we have had regimes in Iran that are not particularly friendly to the United States. Is that correct?
That's putting it mildly. Actually, I think you could argue that the U.S.-Iran relationship is the most dysfunctional relationship between any two countries in the world. There's no other two countries that have been snarling at each other so angrily and so bitterly for so long.
Well, except for the U.S. and Soviet Union until 1991, I suppose.
But even then, you know, that one's over. But even then, we understood that there was a kind of a modus vivendi. So we didn't like them. They didn't like us. And after a while, we managed to find ways to deal with the relationship. You know, you don't have to like all the countries in the world, but you have to find a way, even if you dislike them, to see how you can work out some kind of a relationship within that paradigm. That's the challenge we're facing with Iran now.
Yeah, and so now to get to the present day. And one thing, by the way, I want to remind our listeners, and Iran wasn't always Iran. I mean, primarily it's been Persia, and Persia is the one of the oldest countries in the world. They lost to the Greeks back in 490 BC. You know, long before the United States was even way before the United States was even dreamed of. But we have a 225 or so year old country. They have one that's been around for a couple of millennia. Iran itself was a construct, an imperial construct. You want to tell us a bit about that, Stephen, before we jump into the present-day reality?
The important thing to understand is more or less what you just said, and that is that although we treat Iran like Honduras or something like that, a little country that we feel we can push around, this is a country that's existed for about 20 times longer than the United States. It was the first world power. The Persian Empire was the first empire in the world. Cyrus was the emperor who issued the world's first human rights declaration. It's actually enshrined in the United States Senate, along with other great milestones on the road to freedom.
That's not Miley Cyrus we're talking about. That's Cyrus, the later king of Persia.
Yeah. The fact is, this is a country with a very deep sense of itself. It has a very long history and a deep understanding of its place in the world. And you can see that people are looking over their shoulders saying, now, who's this new country that's coming over here and trying to push us around and tell us what to do? There is a great sense in Iran that the dignity and respect that they feel they deserve hasn't been forthcoming. And I think this is something that is shared across the political spectrum in Iran. So I think the United States needs to start with a policy of understanding that this is a country with a deep history and a strong cultural as well as political tradition. It's also a country that tells you something when you look on the map. It's sort of like, I could use this analogy, when you look at the map of Europe, you see Germany is the big country right in the middle. After World War II, there was a lot of anger at Germany for obvious reasons, and there were a lot of people that wanted to punish and crush Germany. Fortunately, wiser minds prevailed, and we had the Marshall Plan. The idea was, in order to prevent Germany from disturbing the peace, you got to bring Germany in. Don't try to push them into a corner.
Right. We learned a hard lesson on that after World War I, where we crushed Germany and wound up with Adolf Hitler. So somebody actually showed a learning curve after World War II, thankfully. What have we learned or not learned in Iran?
If you look at a map of the Middle East, you see now Iran is the big country right in the middle. Also, Iran is surrounded by nuclear powers. They have four countries with nuclear power, nuclear weapons all around them. They've got India, Pakistan, Russia, and Israel. Meanwhile, two countries that border on them have been invaded and occupied by the United States. That's Iraq and Afghanistan. So you can understand that the Iranians are a little bit sensitive when it comes to American pressure.
And now we're exerting, the U.S. is exerting all this pressure to prevent them from getting nuclear weapons, allegedly. And why don't you talk about that? What's really going on there?
It's remarkable to see now in these last months that the main foreign policy issue in this forthcoming presidential election is Iran. That's going to be the issue on which Republicans are going to try to blame President Obama for being too weak and not being tough enough. I think part of it has to do with a sense among some Americans that all negotiation is surrender. You never want to negotiate. You need to have a policy of confrontation and be tough and be punishing. But as long as Iran is constantly pushed into a corner and made to feel alone and friendless and isolated, you are going to have an angry Iran. The way to bring Iran back out of the cold is to have some kind of a new security architecture in that part of the world that takes into account the fact that Iran is a very big, important, powerful country, and it needs to have a role. There is not going to be stability in the Middle East unless Iran feels that some consideration has been given to its possibilities and its role in the region. But as long as we feel that policy of confrontation is the only way we want to go, we're never going to get there. And as long as there's an angry Iran that's outside the international system, it's going to remain a football in American politics.
But Iran has some very strong allies. I mean, they're closely allied with Russia, India, and China. Is that correct?
These are some interesting relationships. I look, it's true, they have friends in the world, but it's not just that they have friends. I say they also have countries that may not approve of what they do, but would love to find ways to bring them into the international system. And I think the two countries that have worked the most on this are India, you mentioned, and also Turkey. What they've done, I think, is something very important. They draw a line between two very different things. One is the question, do you like this country or do you not like this country? That's one question. But then there's a separate question, do you want to attack and punish this country? Just because you don't like what a country does, this does not automatically mean that you need to punish, isolate, and threaten it. So I think that's what the Turks and the Indians are saying. Let's see if we can't bring Iran out of the cold. Actually, Turkey and Brazil made a dramatic effort to do that just a year and a half ago, and they thought they had achieved a great victory. But then as soon as the people in Washington woke up, they slapped down this deal. Seems like we're in a position where we won't take yes for an answer.
Well, the question also arises, if we do attack Iraq, Iran, we've attacked Iraq already, of course. If we do attack Iran, how will the Chinese, Russians, and Indians respond?
You know, I think they'd just sit back and, in a way, they would just smile because they would realize the United States has just inflicted another terrible wound on itself. Our strategic power in the world lost tremendously because of our invasion of Iraq. We thought that was the way we were going to build up our power. It has wound up greatly empowering countries that we don't like. And in fact, the only real winner from the Iraq War was Iran. We handed that country over to Iran on a platter. That's the country supposed to be our biggest enemy. Don't forget, Iran is, of course, the center of the Shiite Islam world, and Iraq is mainly Shiite. So now Iraq is more or less under Iranian influence. We thought we were hurting Iran. Actually, we presented them with a huge gift. If we now become the country that is going to start another war against another Muslim country, we will be inflicting another terrible strategic wound on ourselves, and all of our strategic competitors in the world will love this.
And, of course, the pretense that's being used now to justify an attack on Iran is the same one they used in Iraq, which turned out to be baseless. The idea that somehow this misbegotten Middle Eastern country is going to wind up with nuclear weapons.
As I said, of course, they have some reason to want that option at least available to them. Their biggest enemy in the world, that's the United States, and their biggest enemy in the region, that's Israel, are both nuclear-armed powers. I think Iran also has learned a lesson from the way the United States has treated Libya and Iraq and North Korea. The way we've treated them is, if you have a nuclear weapon, we're not going to attack you. Iraq did not have one. North Korea did. I think that's why we attacked Iraq, and we have never attacked North Korea. With Libya, we taught the world another lesson. And that is what happened with Libya. Gaddafi had nuclear weapons. He voluntarily gave them up under our pressure. And as soon as he did that, we came in and killed him. This is going to have a great impact in the world, and it's already having an impact in Iran today. Now, as to the details of what's going on in Iran, the fact is International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors are all over Iran. They're there right now. They have certified repeatedly that none of Iran's uranium has been diverted to military use. And in fact, all of Iran's uranium is stored under IAEA seals. And when there are no inspectors in the country, those seals are being monitored with cameras that are being watched in Vienna and probably in Langley and a lot of other places. In order to begin building a weapon, they'd have to break those seals. That would be a warning to the world. We would then have to pull our weapons inspectors out. So the idea that you could launch a surprise attack somehow, or that Iran would somehow have a nuclear weapon, we'd wake up one day and suddenly it would be finished, this does not coincide with reality.
Right. And, you know, aside from manufacturing one, I'm sure they could just purchase something on the black market on a few moments' notice and have its equivalent. We're talking with Stephen Kinzer, author, journalist, activist, about Iran and the Middle East and the prospect of war with Iran, which is terrifying to anybody who knows anything about the United States and the American economy. And speaking of the economy, Stephen, I have read a number of pieces since the confrontation with Saddam Hussein saying that it's really not in either country, either Iraq or Iran. It's not really about nuclear weapons. It's about the petrodollar. And that the real reason that we went after the George W. Bush, Karl Rove, and Dick Cheney went after Saddam Hussein, and the real reason now we're so concerned about Iran, is that there is a threat that they will start trading oil in euros or in metals as opposed to the dollar. And that if the petroleum trade goes off the dollar, the American dollar will plummet 50% or more, and that's what this is really about. What do you think about that theory?
I think there's some truth to that, but I would even go further. It's beyond just the currency problem. The United States is still stuck on its terrible addiction to oil. If that were not true, our whole policy in the Middle East would be completely different. Saudi Arabia is one of the main enemies of Iran. The United States has now allied itself closely with Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has a government and a society that has nothing in common with ours. This is a country where women can't drive or vote. It's a country where you can be whipped for drinking alcohol. It's the oddest ally for the United States. If it weren't for oil, we would have nothing to do with Saudi Arabia, and we wouldn't be so deep into Saudi Arabia's anti-Iran project. So it isn't just the currency thing. The oil aspect of our policy toward the Middle East will continue to dominate our strategic thinking in that part of the world. And as long as we are on our oil addiction, we're never going to be able to get over our dictatorship addiction in the Middle East.
Well, of course, now we're trying to switch over to natural gas. And of course, by doing that with fracking, we're about to destroy our entire water supply, which is another issue, which we'll take up after the break. We're talking with Stephen Kinzer, author, journalist, activist, about Iran. Stephen, if you'll stay with us through the break here, we'll come back. We'll talk a little bit more about Central America, American imperial policy, and also some of your other work, including your excellent vision of the inner strength required for activism. How's that sound?
Sounds great.
Okay, we're here with the Green Power and Wellness Show. This is Harvey Wasserman on Progressive Radio Network, and we're going to hear Dana Lyons now singing the Rocky Top version of Solartopia.
Pipelines, mega dams, Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan, oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam. Sweet home to me, solar.
are listening to PRN.FM, the Progressive Radio Network.
Oh, Jeff.
Yes, Lee?
I just want you to know.
What?
You occupy my heart.
Aw.
Cheater on the Rude with Jeff Chrysler
and Lee Papa.
Thursdays, 8 p.m. Eastern.
Check out our old shows on the archives.
Archives? That sounds like some weird yellow moldy paper stuff.
And you can listen to all of our old moldy shows at PRN.FM.
Did you hear the Progressive Radio Network has a new slogan?
It does.
It does. Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
That sounds sort of progressive.
It does, it does. But I think it needs to be a little more demanding.
Progressive Radio Network is moving forward!
And we want you
to
come
with us.
Hello, I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and you can hear my program, If You Love This Planet, right here on the Progressive Radio Network, every Sunday at 3 p.m. Please join me as I interview a huge variety of special guests from around the world about a range of topics, including the health of the planet and prescriptions for survival. So, if you do love this planet, tune in to the Progressive Radio Network every Sunday at 3 p.m.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your source for news and information.
Hard energy, windmills, hydrogen, photovoltaic cells with solar panels everywhere. Solar cars, fast trains, bicycles, hydroplanes, get you home in under an hour. Clean air, water, rooftop gardens, tidal geothermal power.
All right, that was Dana Lyons, cowswithguns.com for Dana Lyons, his wonderful anthem for the vegetarian movement, singing the Solartopia song. Stephen Kinzer is our guest, author, activist, journalist, truly an expert on Iran, on the Central America, and on American foreign policy towards, shall we say, the resource-rich countries that we've been attacking and exploiting all these years. Stephen, are you back with us?
I am, and enthusiastically so.
Excellent. Well, it's great to have you on. This critical topic. I mean, I marched against the war in Vietnam. You're probably much younger than I am. So I remember the great moment in my intellectual, shall we say, transition on the war in Vietnam was I read a book by John Gerasi called The Great Fear in Latin America, and suddenly realized that we're doing exactly in Latin America what we're doing in Vietnam, just not quite so dramatically and in the eye of the television world. And it sort of clicked. Everything that the U.S. was doing had to do with resource extraction and military dominance, as opposed to this nonsense that we're out there spreading democracy. In fact, we're killing democracy wherever we possibly could do so. Was that a new left SDS overstatement, or was I accurate, Stephen?
Well, I think it's certainly true that our interventions abroad have a fundamentally economic basis. This goes all the way back to the Spanish-American War and the Philippines War of over 100 years ago. The American farmers and American manufacturers had mastered the techniques of production so well that we were producing much more than Americans could consume. And without foreign markets, they would go bankrupt. We had a lot of trouble in the United States. There was labor violence. There were strikes. There were panics and economic depressions in the late 19th century. This drove American interventionism, and we adopted a policy that we called the open door policy. We wanted all countries to have an open door to us, but when they didn't, we forced them to. So I always thought a better name for that policy would be the kick-in-the-door policy.
Right.
Having markets and having opportunities to get the resources that we need from other countries has been a fundamental purpose of American interventionism and American foreign policy from the very beginning.
So what would be, if we attacked Iraq, God forbid, what would be the real motivation? Why would we do it?
I think, first of all, there's a political factor inside the United States that has really nothing to do with Iran at all. It just has to do with this sense that Americans should be out there imposing our will and making countries do what we want and not negotiating with them, since negotiating always implies that you're not going to get everything you want. This is not the American way. Americans don't like to understand things. We like to do things. So I think there is that pressure inside the United States. When it comes to Iran itself, I think the reality is that Iran is a very big country. It's four times the size of Iraq, and has three times the population of Iraq. It's a much more advanced and older country. This is a country that believes it should play a role in the Middle East. And its view of what the Middle East needs is very different from the American view. We don't want a country that's big and powerful in the Middle East that has a different view of how the Middle East should evolve than we do, particularly if that's a country that's sitting on an ocean of oil and gas. I think the strategic imperative of not allowing that country to rise to power is very important. The nuclear issue is a subset of that. Actually, I've been told by people in Israel that the security establishment in Israel doesn't really fear that a nuclear-armed Iran would ever bomb Israel. They understand that that would mean the liquidation of Iran in an hour, and the Iranians are not that crazy. Nonetheless, the Israelis have learned something very important about having a nuclear weapon, and it is that when you have one, you don't have to use it. You automatically have more influence. You can intimidate people. You can push people around. You can impose your will on people, and that is what we don't want Iran to be able to do.
And what lengths do you think we're willing to do that? I mean, Obama seems to be resisting, at least so far, attacking Iran. I don't know that Newt Gingrich would be so restrained, and I'm not sure about Mitt Romney either.
It's interesting that our last defense secretary, Robert Gates, who was, of course, the holdover from the George W. Bush administration, and our present defense secretary, Panetta, have both made very clear their views that in the long run we would hurt ourselves more than help ourselves by an attack on Iran. But they are reacting out of study and out of thought and out of reflection. I think the earlier motive that I mentioned of just kind of political pressure inside the United States, in a sense that Americans should not negotiate, Americans should just act and strike, would be something that might drive a Republican administration. It's easy to say, and probably in many ways true, that there wouldn't be so much difference between a Republican and Democratic administration emerging after these coming elections. But when it comes to Iran, I think there could be a very big difference. It might make the difference as to whether the United States goes to war with Iran or does not. And let me just add one other thing. It's very important to think of this as a war. This is not a military strike. You sometimes hear this phrase, we should strike at their nuclear plants. It's not that simple. This means a full-scale war, and Americans need to understand what that means. We have been at war with two Muslim countries for the last 10 years. We are on the brink of doing this in a third country if the Republicans win this election, and I think that's quite a terrifying prospect.
Well, of course, we have to remember in the 20th century, Woodrow Wilson was elected in 1916 on the slogan, he kept us out of war. He was a Democrat, and he was inaugurated in March and got us into war in April of 1917. Franklin Roosevelt, of course, we were attacked, although some people have a conspiracy theory about that, also argued a campaign against war, and we went into World War II. Harry Truman, you know, was not exactly a war candidate and got us into Korea. And then Lyndon Johnson, most devastatingly in the post-World War II era, campaigned in 64, very famously as a peace candidate, and then escalated the war in Vietnam in March 65, which I think is the dates the downfall of modern United States. The only president in the 20th century who campaigned as a peace candidate and kept his promise was Dwight Eisenhower, who said he'd go to Korea in 52, and by God, he did, and ended the war in 53. So the question then becomes, Obama is acting as a peace candidate right now, but can we trust that if he's reelected come March, April, May of 2013, he's not going to do what Woodrow Wilson, Lyndon Johnson did in the 20th century?
Well, I wouldn't move on trust, that's for sure. I do think that Obama understands the dangers of going to war with Iran, that he was going to go to some lengths to try to avoid that. But your analogies of history are kind of interesting. I still remember the great line by the conservative writer William F. Buckley, who said, in 1964, I was warned that if I voted for Goldwater, the United States would be sending hundreds of thousands of troops to Iran, to Vietnam, and we'd be involved in a full-scale war there. So I voted for Goldwater. And guess what? That's what happened.
Yeah. Well, you know, the question then becomes, what do we do, God forbid, if either Obama is reelected or Gingrich or Mitt Romney or even, God forbid, Jeb Bush, and people are talking about now. What if we do have this attack does happen? Or how do we prevent it as activists after the election? You gave a speech at a college about the inner strength that's needed to be an activist. Now, many of us, myself included, have been active on peace, environmental issues for, I dare say, 40 years. And at the suggestion of our very wonderful mutual friend, Vivian Simon, can you describe, talk about your feelings and your take on what it really takes to be an effective activist? To oppose things like Iran, which I don't think we're going to solve the Iran situation by elections. We're going to have a strong enough grassroots movement to prevent it from happening. Where do you see the core of that possibility coming?
I do think you're right that people outside government have a big role in this. You know, in the last year of the Bush administration, it really seemed like we might be going to war with Iran, and there was a great popular uprising against this. There was a lot of warning about it, and I do think that activists who warned against this prospect did have some effect. In a broader
even,
sense,
even on Bush and Rove?
Pardon? Yes, I do. I think, of course, you had a change in State Department. You had Condoleezza Rice emerging to replace Rumsfeld. So things changed inside the White House, and I do think that public opinion played a role in the decision not to do that in Iran in the last year of the Bush administration. As for the broader question of activism. Activism is a very frustrating role anywhere, but certainly in the United States at this time, it's especially so. The level of democracy in this country has markedly decreased in the time that you and I have been alive, which is actually a relatively short period of history. When we were born or when we were kids, this country was in many important ways more democratic than it is now. We have lost a good measure of our democracy, and that places a greater responsibility on people who want to act outside the electoral system. I don't want to say outside the political system, but outside of electoral politics. This kind of work can be intensely frustrating because change is so incremental and resistance to change is so intense. I believe that the way that you can avoid the danger of burnout and anger and frustration and resignation is to try to weave your activism into a sustainable long-term life. You can't be totally immersed in something 24 hours a day for a whole lifetime. That doesn't work. You burn out. You need to find a sustainable life in which activism is a continuing but not exclusive part of how you approach life. So to me, you need to understand that activism is a spiritual and emotional as well as a political statement. You want to integrate an understanding of the kind of world we want to get to with the very difficult and frustrating work of trying to influence the political system on a day-to-day basis.
Well, of course, we did have a lot of that back at the turn of the century. You talked about the war in the Philippines and the Spanish-American War and its shall we say, ripple effect. There was a socialist movement in this country, a profoundly powerful, very spiritual leader named Eugene V. Debs, who was really the American Gandhi at the time. And there was a deep sense of this, which was really wiped out in many ways during World War One. And now we come back full circle here. I tried to do a little bit of that kind of visioning in my book Solartopia, and there's certainly plenty of other spiritually oriented treatises out there, people talking about it. What do you think? I don't want to lose this track. You know, people are activists. Are often always told actually that we're not having any impact. And I was really glad to hear you say that your belief that the popular opposition really may have prevented George W. Bush from attacking Iran at the end of his regime. Those of us who marched against the war in Vietnam got a tremendous boost recently from, of all people, Richard Nixon from the grave, who and the some documents came out. And also he mentioned this in his autobiography very briefly in a footnote, that it's pretty clear now that had it been not been for the movement against the war in Vietnam, the very powerful and important grassroots movement that sprung out 1966, 67 in particular, that it had it not been for that movement, Nixon would have used nuclear weapons in Vietnam. So listening in, if you get frustrated as an activist, and I think Stephen would, and I would like more confirmation from this from you, Stephen, if you ever think you're not having an impact, go read Richard Nixon's autobiography and realize, I mean, the world would have been such a catastrophically different place if we had used nuclear weapons in Vietnam or if George Bush had attacked Iran. And now we have the same burden again. What's the key here, Stephen, to an individual looking to make a difference?
I'd give you a more recent example. Even in the Republican Party debates, you are now starting to see an argument over whether the way Bain Capital and hedge funds operate is really what capitalism is supposed to be like, or is that a perversion of our idea of what economic freedom was? This is now becoming a big issue in America. People are debating this, whether our economic system is fair or not. This whole idea of the 99% and the way that a small group of people manage to job the political system to achieve their economic wealth and secure it, I believe that a lot of this comes from the Occupy movement. Those kids that were out there and those adults that were out there on the streets and camping out have really had an impact because nobody was talking like this a year ago. So you can't say that the political will for a dramatic change in our economic system has triumphed yet. But this is an issue that is on America's front page. It's on our political agenda now. It was not on our political agenda a year ago. And I can't believe that the Occupy movement does not have an influence over that. So anybody that was out there or supporting those people that were out there can feel a sense of satisfaction. We have made some progress, and activists are the ones who deserve the credit for that.
Yeah, I had a great opportunity to speak to the Occupy Boston encampment, and it was really a fabulous experience. And, you know, what an amazing moment. And it really did remind me of the old days back in the Vietnam era, which were so much fun. And we had a lot of lessons to learn. I mean, the Occupy movement has really learned the lessons of, in many ways, of nonviolence, of empowerment of women. You know, people who look at this country and say we haven't made progress weren't paying attention in the 50s and 60s. You know, tremendous strides have been made in civil rights. I remember back then we kept saying, oh, well, someday we'll have a black president. You know, nobody talked about homosexuality at all. And now you're having a movement for them for gays to get married. I mean, we have made tremendous strides. So the question now is, Stephen, do you believe that the grassroots opposition in this country is strong enough to stop the attack on Iran?
I think a lot of it depends on the other end. That is to say, you always, in order to have progress in a political system, need to have pressure from below, and you also have to have some responsiveness from above. I think that the way to frame the Iran argument is not to say that Iran should do this or should not do that. It really should be about the United States. I think this is what appeals to most Americans. Most Americans are not interested to hear about what's good for somebody else. When you cloak interventions in the garb of we're trying to help other people, we're trying to support human rights or NATO or the United Nations, I always get worried when I hear that. I think the argument ought to be this is bad for us. We need a stable Middle East for our economy and for peace in the world. It's not going to be good for us if our allies in that part of the world are surrounded by people that hate them. We are going to foment terrorism like we've never seen before. If you think that Iranians are unfriendly toward the United States now, just bomb them and start killing their children and see what they say then. You are going to see Afghanistan set on fire. You are going to see Americans killed all over the world. You are going to see the Straits of Hormuz closed. You are going to see long-term damage to the United States. And I think that even for people across the political spectrum, this is a potent argument. Instead of arguing what many of us may believe about what this is going to mean for the rest of the world, focus on how bad an idea it is for us. And I think then you can capture the hearts of people across the political spectrum.
Well, what, for example, obviously killing people, horrifying death toll, environmental damage would be horrific. What's it going to do to the American economy?
Well, I think the economy will be seriously damaged because of the control that Iran has over the Persian Gulf. And I think oil prices would skyrocket. I think you would see also terrible consequences for America's attempt to withdraw from its military over involvements in the rest of the world. The throwing of another great factor of instability into the world is something that the world can't, at this very unstable moment, sustain. It isn't just the American economy, it's the world economy. It's delicately balanced, and I think people who are thinking about economics realize that another war that turns huge numbers of people against the West and against the United States will be catastrophic, not just in security terms, but in economic terms for the West and for the United States.
Yeah, and what would it do to the petrodollar? Since, you know, no one's talked much about this, but since the overthrow of Mossadegh, the whole oil business has been built on the dollar. I'm assuming that if we attack Iran, there would be a huge reaction, and people would probably other countries would probably try to move off of it. What, do you see that as a possible scenario?
I do think that there will be fears that the dollar will suffer as a result of any further economic dislocation in the world. Now, of course, the euro isn't doing so well either.
Yeah, but gold and silver haven't moved around much.
But you could easily see a move if traditional economic channels are closed to Iran, towards more barter agreements. You'd see agreements with countries like India and China in which oil is bartered for other kinds of supplies. Every time a country is isolated, there are other nations that want to take advantage of its isolation and go in and try to break that. You cannot, in the modern world, marshal a coalition of all the countries in the world to just isolate one. There are going to be some among those all who will dissent from that coalition and will make it impossible for isolation to be complete. So we need to understand that the United States, despite what we might want, cannot shape the course of events. You know, we have this view that with military power we can achieve what we want. And I think you're only able to believe that if you think in very short term. So the United States has the military power to achieve the result we want in the short run anywhere in the world. But the
long-term
consequences are devastating.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I just want to. Are you convinced that if the United States set out to rid Iran of its alleged nuclear weapons, that we'd actually succeed?
No, I believe that we would only manage to postpone the time when Iran gets a nuclear weapon. They will, in fact, an attack will just prove their point, which is that as long as we don't have nuclear weapons, we are vulnerable. So in the short run, we feel good. Okay, they're not going to get their nuclear weapon this year, although there's no indication that they would anyway. But in the long run, things get even worse. Unfortunately, Americans are not good at thinking about the long run. When you use that phrase, you've already lost people in the United States. And I sometimes think that maybe this goes beyond the national character of Americans, and that there's almost something biological about it. In evolutionary terms, it has only been very recently, in the last couple of centuries, that human beings have ever had to think more than a few hours or one day ahead. For most of the time there have been human beings, you only had to think about when you're going to kill your next animal and have your next meal. That was it. And I think that got bred into our genes. I think about today and tomorrow, but you don't think about 10 years from now. In this world, you need to think about 10 years from now, but our minds are not geared for that. And I think that's one big change we need to make.
Yeah, as a species and as a country, there's no doubt about it. We're talking with Stephen Kinzer, author, activist, journalist, mostly about Iran. Stephen, you spent some time in Central America. How do you see things correlating between what's happening now with the United States to Iran as opposed to or in conjunction with what we've done in Latin America?
American impulse to intervene has always had its shown its face most vividly in Latin America, and particularly in the Caribbean Basin, in Central America and Caribbean countries. These were countries that we felt we needed to be able to control, and was particularly countries that had resources we wanted were thought of as essentially colonies of the United States. We saw this in Guatemala in the 1950s. Any kind of defiance is considered a motivation for the United States to strike back. That's what happened during the 1980s in Nicaragua. I was living in Nicaragua then, and Nicaragua was then, as it is now, a miserably poor, very small, rural, undeveloped country. I used to have visitors that would come down to Nicaragua, and I would drive them around and show them the way people are living in these cardboard shacks, and children are running around in their bare feet and playing in the mud because there's no water. And I would tell them, take a look. This is the threat. This is the terrible threat to the United States that you're hearing about in Washington. We love, and this is an old idea. Philosophers like Arnold Toynbee have written about this. We love the idea of having enemies. And some have argued, like Toynbee, that if countries don't have enemies, they should create enemies. Because without enemies, you don't have coherence as a society. You don't have a united national purpose. And I think that some of this, consciously or unconsciously, filters into our approach to the world. We feel like even a little tiny country like Nicaragua can be built up into a threat to this giant behemoth of the United States rather than the reality, which is the other way around.
Right. What's that right out of George Orwell's 1984, really, where we had a perpetually changing mega enemy and kept everybody terrorized by the situation. Stephen, do you have a website that people can go to, and can you tell us the titles of some of your books?
Yes. My website is stephenkinzer.com, so it's Stephen with a P-H and K-I-N-Z-E-R. I have written a book, which I think might be interesting for those concerned with the topics we've been discussing, which is called Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. What I do there is write about the 14 times that the United States has overthrown a foreign government. I wrote that book in reaction to this idea that George W. Bush was radically departing from American history by attacking Iraq and Afghanistan, and I wanted to show that actually he was acting right in concert with American history. So Overthrow is the story of these interventions that you don't read about in a lot of history books.
And when was that book published, and where is it available?
It was just published 3 or 4 years ago. It should be available on that big website that's named after a river in South America that I don't want to mention because it's become so predatory. But if you go down to your local bookstore, your local independent store, they will happily supply you with a copy.
Okay, we like that. Give us the title of some of your other books.
Well, I've written two books about the overthrows of foreign governments. I wrote one I mentioned earlier called All the Shah's Men, about the overthrow of the Mossadegh government in 1953. That was the first time the CIA ever overthrew a government. And then I've written a book about the next intervention, the second CIA coup against the Arbenz government in Guatemala. That one is called Bitter Fruit. And my most recent book is called Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future. It proposes a new American approach to the Middle East and definitely touches on a lot of what we've been discussing.
Well, give us a 60-second overview of what your new foreign policy would look like.
What I would like to see is, first of all, an understanding that the United States can't operate alone in the world, and it can't operate alone in the Middle East. I also argue that our traditional alliance pattern is now outdated. We have a great policy for the Cold War, but the Cold War has been over for decades. We don't evolve. Our policies don't change. Our traditional allies in that part of the world have been Israel and Saudi Arabia. But in the modern world, Turkey is a country that's much more in tune with America's needs and has a society much more like the United States than Saudi Arabia or Israel. And in the long run, the only other country in the Muslim Middle East that has a long tradition of democracy, an advanced civil society, and a sophisticated ambition for the world is Iran. Iran is also the most pro-American country in the world when it comes to the population. In my visits to Iran, I am always shocked by this. People will shriek when they hear you're from the United States. I had one woman say to me, "I know they say terrible things about us over there, but we love America so much." This pro-American sentiment in Iran is a huge strategic asset for the United States. Anything we do to liquidate that asset is suicidal, and nothing will liquidate it more quickly than bombing them.
Well, we hope that your next gig will be on Fox News, and we'll get that message out. Stephen Kinzer, you've been a great guest. I hope you'll come back sometime and do another show with me. We've been talking with Stephen Kinzer, author, journalist, activist, about Iran and American foreign policy. It's been a great show, Stephen. Thank you so much. Next week, I expect to talk about holistic alternative ways of dealing with cancer. In the meantime, this has been Harvey Wasserman with another Solartopia Green Power and Wellness show on the Progressive Radio Network. Thank you so much, crew in the studio, and we'll see you next week.